Jim Henson once said, "Watch out for each other. Love everyone and forgive everyone, including yourself. Forgive your anger, forgive your guilt, your shame, your sadness. Embrace and open up your love, your joy, your truth, and most especially, your heart." This is the Producers Lounge Podcast. Welcome back for Season 2, Episode 4, hosted and produced by GreaterAndGrander.com. On this week's episode, we're chatting with Anthony Q. Farrell, who has produced TV shows including the BAFTA-winning Secret Life of Boys, the Parker Andersons' Amelia Parker, and the upcoming Overlord and the Underwoods. Having begun his writing career writing for The Office under executive producer Greg Daniels, he quickly exploded onto the TV writing scene with deals for Nickelodeon and Disney, before moving back to become a successful showrunner in Canada. Also, just a quick note, Anthony and I had some internet connectivity issues during the interview. I tried to edit around it, but if you hear any odd audio modulation during the process, that's why. Here now is my conversation with Anthony Q. Farrell. How thick is the snow up there in Toronto?
We got a few inches over the last couple days. When did it start? I guess it started a night or two ago. But it's been like really mild. I think one of the days last week was so funny because someone mentioned that it was warmer in Toronto than it was in LA a couple days ago. So, you know, every once in a while we'll have a kind of like a mild December, but with all the climate change talk that's going on now, it feels even more present because, you know, everything feels, at least here in Toronto, everything feels like the seasons are shifting by like a month or two. It just kind of, everything feels like it's sliding back a little bit. Like it took a little while for summer to kick off and then it really kicked off. And then it took a little while for winter to kick off. And then I'm assuming January, February, and March are going to be really cold. It's going to make up for lost time. So we'll see. Who knows what this wacky world has got in store for us.
Who knows? It's funny you bring that up because, like, I've noticed the same thing down here because, you know, when I first moved to L.A. longer ago than I care to admit, it was, you know, you had like, you know, fall was actually kind of a thing. Now it seems like you're getting up in like 90 degree days up until October, and then November it just suddenly drops. So it's yeah.
I moved away from L.A. I was in L.A. basically from 2004. To mm-hmm. 2017. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I remember even in that time, that short amount of time, like what the weather was when we first moved there and what it became, you could tell there was a little bit of a shift.
Definitely. Did you have snow where you grew up? Or
yeah, I actually grew up, so I mean, I grew up in Toronto mostly.
Oh, okay.
But I also grew up in St. Kitts and Nevis a little bit too. Like, my parents are from the Caribbean, so I was born in Toronto, but until I was 8 we moved back and forth quite a bit. Like, I would go to school in St. Kitts and then I go to school in Toronto, then we kind of go back and forth. I always tell people, like, there are literally days when I was making a snowman on Saturday, then I'm at the beach on Sunday. So it was just kind of like, it was a little bit of a it was a little bit of a weird thing. And then after I turned 8 we kind of settled like for real in Toronto, and then we kind of stopped moving back and forth.
Okay, cool. Can I ask what about your childhood had you moving back and forth? Were your parents in the military or anything?
No. Like, they were, my dad was, he owned businesses, or he was a manager of businesses in St. Kitts. Like, my parents were from there, so they grew up there. And so he had like a budget rent-a-car thing that he was a manager of in St. Kitts, and then he would do taxes and he would do real estate in Canada. So depending on what was going on, like, I'd either be in St. Kitts while they're working on that business, or I'd be in Toronto while they were like doing stuff up there. So it felt like, I honestly don't know why, like what the impetus was for moving back and forth, but it was just kind of like a family trying to make it, just hustling, just trying to go where the money is at the time. So that's what it was. And I think also I had a younger brother, younger sister. And I think whenever they were about to be born, we would be in Canada. We'd make sure that we were in Canada so that everyone was born.
So you'd have Canadian citizenship. I see.
Yeah. Because at that point, my dad and my mom, they're definitely landed immigrants, because they got I don't know when they got their citizenship, but my dad had citizenship from St. Kitts, and he also had citizenship from the United Kingdom. And then they also got sponsored by my aunt when they immigrated here. And obviously, being sponsored and everything was a different situation back in the 70s, because there were really, you know, a lot back then, there's a lot of hustling with, like, you know, in the UK, they had the Windrush with a lot of people from the Caribbean going in the 50s and 60s. And then in Canada, they started doing the same thing with Pierre Trudeau in the late 60s and 70s. And so there's a lot of people coming from the islands to these colder places during the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
That's fascinating. I actually never knew that about the Windrush. That's interesting.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, you know, the West Indies Rush. It was a big thing. And then it was like a lot of, you know, and you see like with Steve McQueen, like he had that show Small Axe.
Oh yeah.
That was on Amazon. That's kind of like, that's one of those shows that kind of talks about like what that influx of people from the West Indies, from the Caribbean meant to not only the people who moved there, but to the people who've already been there, right? Like it's just kind of like whenever you have a change in the community, like that, there's going to be pain. There's going to be things that are, there's going to be growing pains, right? So it definitely led to a lot of growing pains, but obviously there's a lot of people who are still in the UK and who've raised their families there. And same thing in Canada, a lot of people here who are from the Caribbean. There's a big island community here, like one of the biggest Caribbean festivals in the world called Caribana is done here in Toronto. So, you know, there's a big community here. I'm definitely not in this boat alone when it comes to, you know, first generation Canadians whose parents are from the Caribbean. There's a lot, there's a lot of us here.
Let me ask, like, so when, around this time, when did you get your first interest in going into entertainment?
Probably when I was really young. I got into like theater, mm-hmm. In university. I also got like in high school and university. And then I always tell people like the first little bit of like, you always remember like, you know, the first time you were making people laugh. And like, one of the big times is when we used to do speeches in grade school, like you'd have to figure out like your speeches, and then you do it in front of the class. And then if you did a really good one in front of the class, you mm-hmm. get to do it in front of the school. And then if you did it in front of the school and you were really good, you get to go and do it in front of like a region, like, you know, the regional. So I was really into like doing funny speeches, like, because I wanted people to laugh and I wanted to get, you know, I was that kid that wanted to entertain. So that's when I first realized, oh, this is kind of a cool, fun thing to do. And I watched a lot of TV growing up. Like I was just always in front of the TV. I watched any sitcom that was available for me to watch in the 80s and 90s. I just kind of soaked it all in. But I kind of got it started to kind of get a sense like, you know, I kind of would love to act or write or do something. And I started acting, went to theater school, mm-hmm. Doing a lot of production stuff, a lot of acting. Then through theater, I started acting and writing, and then I started doing sketch comedy and doing improv, and I kind of started branching out from there. And then after I branched out, one of the things that kicked off for me professionally, after doing all, you know, doing all the theater and everything for free, mm-hmm. the first thing that kind of kicked off professionally was writing. I started getting writing jobs. And then after all that widening out and focusing on different things, I kind of then honed back in on the thing that was bringing money bringing money home. So I started focusing on the writing side of things, specifically for TV comedies.
And this was all still in the Toronto scene, or had you moved to LA at this point?
I'd moved to LA. So the way it worked out was like, I went to school in Toronto. My wife mm-hmm. and I, we got married. In 2001, we moved to Atlanta. We're in Atlanta for a few years. I was doing community theater there and that kind of stuff. And then in 2004, we moved to LA. And that's what I was doing. I was doing theater there. I was doing groundlings, improv, doing mm-hmm. sketch comedy with my sketch troupe, The Audacity. And then one of my friends was like, who saw one of the plays that I had written and directed, he said, you should write for TV. And I was like, well, how does that happen? And then he was the one that introduced me to his lit manager, mm-hmm. Cherie Guitar. And Cherie runs like a comedy workshop mm-hmm. on Saturdays where writers come in, bring their scripts. We'd have them cold read by actors, and the actors would leave, and then all the writers that were there, we would become a writing room for each other.
Oh, wow.
And Cherie would kind of run that. And so based on how you do in that room, she might pick you up as a client, which she did for me. And she's actually still my manager today. This has been the last 16 years she's been repping me. So, and then she's fantastic. She used to be a writer herself. She was a writer. She wrote on Roseanne and Harry and the Hendersons. And so when I get notes from Cherie, it's from like a real, it's from a place or another writer is giving you notes, right? It's not just from a rep who's never done the job. She's done the job. So that led to, that's kind of what led to me meeting showrunners and doing different programs, different diversity programs. You know, the Fox diversity program I got into an NBC showcase, which led to my scripts getting to Greg Daniels, and then that's what led me my first real WGA writing job.
So
working on The Office.
So I'm curious, like, if we could take a step back, because I find when these interviews, you know, the timeline is very important, because a lot of people, myself included, they hear like, oh, I moved to LA and then I got into this writers group and then and then 2 weeks later I was in the WGA.
So
So how long did that process take from moving to LA all the way to eventually getting to WGA and member of the Office staff?
Now that for me, it was pretty quick for me, but it was like 3 years. So that's pretty quick for most people. Like it doesn't just happen. Like, so 2004, I got there, started working with theater companies. Mm-hmm. And then it took about a year. We did like a lot of shows, a lot of plays. I was writing and directing for this theater company, the Met Theater, auditioning for little things here and there, being in like short films and indie movies and that kind of thing. And then in I think it was the fall of 2005, I had written and directed a play. And then a friend of mine, that's when, you know, I got some good reviews, and my friend kind of introduced me to Cherie at that point. That was like, I want to say like October or November of 2005 is when I met Cherie. Mm-hmm. Started doing her workshop. So in the span 2004, 2005, I had written a bunch of plays, performed and you know, directed them. I was trying to work on a TV spec for Arrested Development at the time. So I kind of did all that as well while I was going through the Groundlings and going through a bunch of different things and trying to do stand-up and all kinds of stuff. I was working during the day at Countrywide Home Loans. So I would kind of work from like, I get on a bus in the morning, go to like, get out to West Hills from North Hollywood, work from like 8:15 to 4:15, get back on the bus, get home, have dinner with my wife. We talk about stuff, she'd fall asleep earlier than I'd like get out into the streets and go do comedy, do stand-up, do improv, something else, whatever was going on. And then that was, you know, a few years of that, meeting Cherie, then still doing the same hustle, but I was now more focused on the writing aspect of it. And between November 2005 and I want to say all up to till the end of 2006, so like a year and a few months, I wrote six scripts. So it was like three original scripts and three spec scripts. I did a spec on Arrested Development, a spec on Two and a Half Men, and a spec on My Name is Earl. So I wrote those over the year. And then during that year, I was meeting different people. I think it was like late 2006, I got into the Fox diversity program. Uh-huh. And that was like a program where they would option your script, and then they put you in the writer's boot camp in Santa Monica for, I think it was a 12-week course. They paid for all of it, and they connected you to Jeffrey Gordon at the writer's boot camp. And that was really cool. And then I also got into an NBC showcase around that same time you had to submit sketches. And then if your sketch was selected, you would work with the director and some actors, and you kind of hone your sketch, get it figured out, and then you perform it in front of NBC industry people. So I was kind of doing both of those at the same time, the NBC thing and the Fox thing. And that led to early 2007, we did the showcase, and also I was done with the Fox program, and my wife was very pregnant at the time. we were excited about the baby coming, but also there are new opportunities springing up. And that's during that time, The Office was doing great and they were looking for new writers. And my scripts were given to Greg Daniels, I think sometime in like April, like March, April 2007 is when he started reading my scripts. And I met him, it was a couple of days before my daughter was born, like April 18th, April 19th, something like that. My daughter was born April 21st. And I remember meeting him in 2007, knowing that we were going to go, my daughter was going to get, we were going to go in on the Saturday that week to induce my wife and have the baby on that Saturday. And I was sitting in the office. I was sitting in the office at the office talking to Greg Daniels about the show. He loved my scripts. I was, this is already freaking me out. And then he invited a bunch of other writers to come in and talk to me after I was talking to him for like 45 minutes. And then Paul Lieberstein and Meg Kaling and Mike Schur and Brett Forrester, and just, they all walk in and then they're asking me questions. And some of them had read my scripts. And I was like, this is blowing my mind. Then I got a tour of the office from Greg's assistant, Mary, who was from Buffalo and I was from Toronto. So we were kind of vibing about being from kind of the same place and we're talking Buffalo, Toronto stuff.
Nice.
And so I'm thinking to myself, I got this job. Like, obviously, why would they treat me so nicely if I don't have to? And then I found out later that there's also like, there's two people that were up for the job. It's myself and another person. And I was freaking out because I just had my kid. I just turned 30. I was in this day job, which was, I'm very happy I had the day job, but I was kind of like, I thought this was it. And then I wasn't sure what was going to happen. Was he going to hire the other person? And then in true Greg Daniels fashion, he found a way to hire both of the people that he wanted, myself and Ryan Coe. On a Monday, I found out. And then on Wednesday, I started working on the office. This is like
3 years. You're not kidding. Like, you were able to really get that far in just 3 years, because it sounds like you had an amazing pedigree going through Fox and going through the NBC showcase. Let me ask, what was your favorite story about that time, going through, you know, in between like arriving in LA and getting into the office?
My favorite story, I think, oh man, there's so many great stories. I think, you know, the thing that I really connected, like I really think about when I think about those times in between when I moved to LA and when I started writing on The Office, was the stuff I was doing at the Met Theater. Like, I started a sketch troupe called The Audacity. Mm-hmm, and we really had free reign of that theater, thanks to the late Paul Coslow and Flint Escara, who were at the Met Theater there on Santa Monica and Santa Monica and Western, somewhere on there, Santa Monica and Western. And then it was just kind of like, you know, if you needed a night to do some sketch comedy, they would like, hey, take this night. It's a black box. There's, you know, not a ton of seats, but, you know, put something up. Like, you know, just kind of go for it. And the creative freedom to be able to do those kinds of things, that's kind of one of the things that kind of honed me as an artist, right? Like, especially in LA, like having someone trust you, and like they literally would give me the keys to the theater to do stuff. And so it was kind of like one of those things where it was like that, having trust like that and having a place to call home as an artist, it's not a little thing, you know. Like, they actually, and it wasn't just me, they opened the doors to a lot of people to give them someplace to create. And I think those are the times that I kind of think about and kind of go, you know, that's, I got to write original things, put them up, see how they sounded, have an audience kind of react. Like, those are the kinds of things you don't like, that are invaluable as an artist trying to find their voice, right? So I think about that specific theater, and those times really turned me into a producer, turned me into a director, turned me into someone who was like thinking about all the things that were not just about writing, not just about the creative side of things, but also the, you know, the monetary side of things as well. So.
And then when you got into the office, it sounds like you were given those opportunities again. I heard that one of the big, I don't know if you call it a big break, but a big thing that helped you at the office was the writer's strike at the time. And you were able to kind of launch like improvised content for the office, for web and for the show as well.
The thing that was crazy about that was that we were all expecting it to be just a week or two. We were thinking, oh, we'll just we'll be gone for a little bit, a week or two later we'll come back and we'll continue what we're doing, because we were in the middle of like a 30 episode season. So we were like, we had just done our hour longs, we had just done our hour long episodes, we had done a few more episodes, we were gearing up to do some really cool stuff. And then, you know, the strike stuff happened, and we were obviously, you know, we were all for
taking care of business, and we just didn't think it was going to take 100 days. So we went on strike, and then days just kind of piled up one after the next. And then it was, it just took a much longer than we expected. And so, you know, things like Strike TV popped up. People were making their own content with holding on to their own IP. We're doing all kinds of stuff like that. And of course, one of the things we wanted to do when we came back was we wanted to figure out ways to you know, keep other writers busy. And when we came back from the strike, you know, we decided we were going to do, you know, some web series. I think Greg and those guys put together some ideas for web series, and that was, you know, web content was becoming more and more a thing. And so we did Kevin's Loans, which was great to do, even because it was a nice way to kind of like have some written by content by yourself, even though I'd been, you know, a part of the process for all of season four. It was nice to have your name on a script after all that. And then, you know, got us ready for having our names on scripts on the big show. So,
yeah, the strike was interesting. It was because it was interesting for a couple of things. I mean, obviously we wanted to fight for what our union wanted. This is my first union. So I didn't even know what all that was really about, but it was kind of cool to be a part of that. Fighting for rights and all those things. And then also just being around the writers for The Office, it meant that I got to meet a lot of other people that they knew while we were on strike. So I kind of got, there was a lot of networking that was happening during then. And it was really just kind of cool to just meet people that had written on the shows that I loved growing up and at the moment. And it was just kind of really cool to be in that cohort, right? So, and then of course, when we came back, Greg wanted to find a way to kind of catch up with things and get writers writing. So we did the Office webisodes. We started kind of doing those, and we did the Kevin's Loan episode that, you know, I got to write with Ryan Coe and Brian Forrester directed. And it was kind of like a nice little setup for us, because then after that, we did that the summer before season five. And then we got to write our own episodes during season five as well. So it was, there was a lot of stuff going on that was just kind of like, it was great to be a part of, but it was just eye-opening on so many levels being in the system at that point.
That's awesome to hear. And it's great that it sounds like Greg Daniels was really supportive as a head writer and showrunner of the people in his staff. I've heard a lot of interesting stories about other showrunners, not Greg Daniels, who were like, no, you can't take meetings and you can't step outside the box and things like that. But it's great that he did that. So.
Yeah, I always, it's funny, if you talk to people who worked with Greg, like the showrunners that came up under Greg, a lot of us are really more compassionate and more open with the writers who are, you know, lower on the ladder, you know, in our staffs. And I think that comes from directly from him, where he's just kind of like, he just kind of, if you're a writer, you've been hired to do that, he's going to let you be a part of the system. And he's not really worried about where the best idea comes from. He doesn't have an ego like that. He's just trying to make the best show possible. And where if the idea comes from a writing assistant or someone else, like it doesn't matter to him. He's just happy to find great stuff to put on TV. So I think as more and more people learn the way of Greg Daniels, writing rooms will become a happier and more, more healthy place. Because I think that's one of the things that I love hearing from my writers, is that they feel like my rooms are healthy places. Like, you know, we obviously have fun. We have there are difficulties in putting stories together and all the normal things that happen in writer's room. But we don't. You're not doing it in a toxic environment. Like this job is hard enough already without adding stress to it, unnecessary stress to it, right? And I think that's one of the things that a lot of us appreciated about, you know, working with Greg.
That is fantastic to hear. And then you were with The Office until about 2009, and then you started to move into shows like In Gale We Trust and Little Mosque on the Prairie. And it looks like, I didn't look at every single one of these shows, but it looks like there are a lot of children's entertainment shows. And I'm wondering what made you want to make that jump.
Was that, it was an interesting story. Like right after I left The Office, I started getting queries from people. You know, Greg was, and Paul Lieberstein and Jen Salata were really good about reaching out to people that they knew and say, hey, Anthony's a good writer, you should talk to him. And so I got a lot of meetings and eventually started developing a series for CBS Studios. And then also what was interesting was Disney reached out, Disney XD specifically. They had read one of my scripts about a pimp that's definitely not written for kids. and they wanted to talk. And I got to the meeting and I was like, my manager said you read my pimp script. And they're like, yeah, we loved it. I'm like, so why am I here? so, but what they said, and it was Phil Bremen and it was John Radler. They're like, listen, here at Disney, we understand that not everyone's gonna write kids scripts as their spec script. But what we're looking for when we read a spec script, we're looking for strong characters, we're looking for great stories, people who know how to, you know, find a, you know, find obstacles and really use them. And that's what this script had. And I was like, oh, okay, that makes sense. So you're talking about transferable skills. I get that. So I pretty quickly started developing for Disney XD. I had a series that they had a nice series idea that I had actually kind of put together for, I was thinking initially for MTV, and then I kind of aged it down a little bit, and they liked it. They're like, oh, this actually works really well. So I was like, oh, cool. So then that's how that started, where I was started writing for kids or for family. And I kind of was just realizing, oh, you know what? This is actually kind of fun. And it's like, you know, it's comedy, and it kind of harkens back to the shows that I watched when I was coming up. So I enjoyed it. And then the next thing I started working on was in the kids space was I started working for Nickelodeon on a few things. And that kind of led me to a place where they were hiring on a show called The Thundermans. And I got that job working on Thundermans. I thought to myself, oh, this will be a fun little thing. I don't know how long, you know, these Nickelodeon shows last, but at least, you know, I'll get to do some for at least, you know, we got like a 13 episode order. I said, cool, I'll get to do some multicam. It was my first multicam like show in production. I got to learn how to do stuff with like laugh tracks and all kinds of stuff. This was a whole new experience. I figured, oh, however long this lasts, great. We went 100 episodes. So I was like, all right, well, this is a pretty cool thing. And then once you're in it, you realize, oh, residual checks as a WGA member from kids shows, especially ones on Nickelodeon, Disney, they're great because they're always replaying their shows because the audience refreshes every three or 4 years, right? Like there's a whole, every year there's a whole new crop of 6-year-olds that are looking for a TV show to watch. So they keep replaying those things over and over and over again. So you ask a lot of, you know, family show, right? Like, you know, family writers, they're happy with what they do, not only because they get to do write comedies that are kind of harking back to the multicams and shows that you watch as a kid, but because those checks are nice, man. Like, I think that's, that you can't lie about that part of it. Is the checks are very nice. And also, like, you know, just be able to have something stable, especially when you're trying to raise a family, especially if you're in LA and how much everything costs. Anytime you have a stable gig like that, you as an artist, you count your lucky stars, right? And so I've been very, very lucky, very, very blessed over the last 15 years to have, you know, 14, 15 years to have been working pretty steadily. You know, there's obviously been a couple of gaps where it's kind of like, oh, well, no work for a year or two here. I'll figure things out. But especially over the last since 2013, really, I've been kind of every year I've been busy. So I've been very, very lucky.
It sounds like it. It sounds like you're very grateful for the process that you landed where you are today.
Absolutely.
And then we come to The Secret Life of Boys. And that is the first show that you got executive producer credit on. How did that come about? Did you pitch that show or?
Yeah, so actually in 2013, right when I started working on Thundermans, at the same time I was kind of doing some rewriting on an animated series for Zodiac Kids. And they were based out in the UK. And they had one of the execs there really liked my episodes of The Office, and they reached out to my manager and were like, hey, would he rewrite animated show? And I was like, yeah, I mean, this sounds like a cool thing. I like meeting people. You never know where this will go. And so while we were working on that, I pitched them, they're like, they like the experience of working with me. And I pitched them another show that I had that I was trying to pitch to Nickelodeon, but they're like, we already have something with Cousins and we weren't sure. They weren't really like sparking to it. And I was like, well, I got this show. I have a pitch deck for this show if you want to take a look at it. And they loved it. And they said, you know what? BBC might really be into this. And so this is like back in, this 2013 actually, they showed BBC the pitch doc, and Cheryl Taylor, who was the head of CBBC, she loved it. And she was like, let's do it. And she said, actually, what we're looking for right now is we're looking for an interactive show. So if we can make this an interactive show, even better. So we said, wow. Of course we can do that. And then we started researching how to turn things into an interactive TV show. And it was a great experience. I mean, it took a little while because the first season was going to be 5 episodes and I was going to write all 5 because the British system is very different. So I actually was doing that while I was working on the Thundermans. It was kind of like my moonlighting gig. The interesting thing with Secret Life of Boys was trying to figure out the interactivity because I wanted a show that wasn't going to be choose your own adventure. I wanted it to be something where you keep the story, but there'd be fun and interesting things happening that you could kind of click into, and then your story would just continue right afterwards. Because as a writer, you work so hard on figuring out the beginning, middle, the end of a story. You don't want it to have to figure out the beginning, the middle, the middle, the middle, the middle, the end, the end, the end. I just was like, I don't want to do that every episode. We had a couple of ideas, but it really kind of kicked off. Really, we really found our niche when we brought in a producer named Trevor Klein. And it was Steve and Andrew, myself, and Trevor Klein that were the producers in the first season. And he had come from some great places where he had worked in like gaming and that kind of stuff. And so he brought some really, really cool ideas, and we kind of honed them and turned it into the first 3 seasons, I think, are actually interactive. So you can actually watch them as a TV show, or you can watch them on the web, and you can press buttons, get extra jokes, find extra secrets. And it's a whole different experience when you watch it online, when you watch it on the computer, on the CBBC website. So that was really cool to crack and to figure out. And I do think we're maybe 20 years ahead of ourselves. Because I do think in about 10 years, someone's going to go, well, what happened to this thing? And then people are going to be all over it again. But yeah, that was a really cool experience. And then we ended up doing 5 seasons. The last 2 seasons were not interactive, but it was great because we had even for all 5 seasons, we had a 23 minute version. And then we had the interactive version that had extra funny gags and extra silly things and extra secrets that you can find. And it just really, it turned into a different thing, and kids really connected to it and sparked to it. And so that was a lot of fun to figure out. And I think there's a way to do that now that everyone's watching shows on phones and on iPads. There's a way to do it for adults for sure. And I think it's just got to be figured out. Netflix is trying to do something similar, but theirs is all choose your own adventure. And I think it's a little bit, I just think it's as sophisticated as it can be yet.
Yeah, and if I recall correctly, that the Netflix one, I forget what it was called, Bender Spink or something, but it was very laggy and not a great experience. It was an episode of Black Mirror, and it was just not.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it sounds like the work you did and the research you did and the format you chose really paid off, because you did win a BAFTA for that show.
Yeah. Yeah, we did. We won a BAFTA. We got nominated for a lot of awards throughout the years. It was a great experience. Great show. A lot of people. Fantastic people worked on the show. The cast is great. The directors are great. Crew's great. My writers were excellent. It was, I can't say enough about that experience.
That is great. And I'd like to also ask you about the process at this point, because it's funny you mentioned Disney XD earlier, because I actually did. It's funny, I went into for a pitch for Disney XD for a show idea I had, but it was just to like a handful of creative execs, and then it didn't really go anywhere. And I'm wondering, obviously, you pitch to various networks, but at what point, like, who makes the final decision? What is that process like of pitching to a network? How many levels are there, and who actually is responsible for making the decision? Like, okay, we're going to go forward with this. I assume Bob Iger and Sumner Redstone are not those people, because that's a bit high up. But
no, it was. Oh man, was it? Was it Rob? Rob, I feel like Rob Marshall feels like the right name. It's been such a long time. But what happens is you meet, so for instance, we were at the time, this is 2010 now, but basically at the time it was, we were dealing with like managers and just different execs who were like in the development side of things, VP of contents, those kinds of people. And then you work with them to figure out the show and to do a bunch of different drafts. And when they feel it's ready, you kind of, they will take it to, I think, who did I sit with? Oh man, I sat with, so it was John Rattler I was working with, and then Phil Bremen, who's now at, I think he's at Netflix. I'm not sure where Phil is. I know John Rattler's at Imagine now, but they had to run it up to their boss, and I had to have a meeting with their boss at some point to kind of like pitch him the idea and say, this is what I want to do with it. This is where a couple of seasons are, blah, blah, blah. And then he just kind of sat there and listened and had some questions, and then, all right, thanks. And that was it. And then it didn't go any, that was kind of like, they chose not to move forward with it. But if they chose to go forward, that would be the person that would green light things. And then we'd have to, then I get to go and make a TV show. But unfortunately for that show, it didn't work out in my favor. But you know, it's one of those things where like there are so many shows now that sometimes you get greenlit, sometimes you don't, and it's always there's always one person or a group of people who are kind of like making that decision at the end of the day. And every broadcaster's kind of got a different kind of setup, but like usually you're talking to execs on the development side of things, you're developing with those people, and then when they're ready, they take it to their bosses, and then their bosses kind of go, oh, I like this, or is this what you've been working on? And then they throw something, they walk away. So that's kind of the process. And then when you get to a certain level, like I'm sure like, you know, there's certain people who have gotten hit shows and they skip that level where they're working with someone else before they decide, they're just working with the top person.
So, and then after Secret Life of Boys, you moved on to the Parker Andersons and Amelia Parker. And that was a really interesting show because it was about a blended family. But also I know on that show, you did an all BIPOC writer's room. And I was wondering what was that was like assembling that writer's room.
That one, it was a little bit zany because I actually took that show over about 4 weeks before we were going to start shooting. So that one was a little bit wilder. Like the previous showrunner, was an older white man who was writing characters, and black directors who were coming in to meet with him weren't feeling the black characters were being taken care of as well as the white characters. And so they were declining working on the show. And when that's happening over and over again, the producers realized that they had a problem and they needed to sort of solve it. So they reached out to me, and then long and the short of it is I ended up taking over the show a few weeks before they were supposed to start shooting. And part of the thing was I didn't want to have to explain why we were changing things. Mm-hmm. I wanted to just kind of go because we had no time left. And all the scripts that I had read needed very big rewrites. So I got together some writers that I knew and some writers that I didn't know, but I had knew of. And so we put together, there were myself, Jay Vadia, Amanda Joy, who I had, both of those two I had worked with on Overlord and the Underwoods already. They were on the staff of that. And then I brought in Ian Stamen, who is Canadian-British writer. And then I brought in Murray Peters, who was actually working on the show with the other showrunner, but she just wasn't being listened to as much as she should have been. And then Sadia Durrani was our script coordinator. And so we came together, we kind of read all the scripts. I said, hey, we're gonna have to rewrite all these scripts like pretty much from page one. And I had a process put together where we were basically like re-breaks, like we weren't even outlining stories at this point. We were basically re-breaking it, sending the broadcasters a one page kind of like battle plan explaining how we were gonna change things. Mm-hmm. Once they approved that battle plan, we would go right to script. And so the writer would go, so each writer, we rebroke the first 10 episodes, and each writer basically took two episodes and had to write those two episodes over the span of 2 weeks before the table read. And then the table reads were basically of first or second drafts of those scripts. Like we didn't have time to do very much rewriting after that. And then we got the shooting drafts. And then once we got the first 10 kind of squared away, we went back in and we rebroke the second half of the season, the back 10. So while I'm on set, the writers are with my co-EP Jay Vadia, and they were like re-breaking stories and kind of like doing stuff while I was on set working with directors and cast and getting the first 10 ready. It was it was honestly, it was not not the way anyone should make a show. We got through it because we had really good writers, we had a really great cast, we had, you know, it was one of those things where we, everyone kind of pulled together to make it happen. And in fact, to the point where most of the crew did not realize that we had started on the show only a few weeks. Some of them actually started on the show before we did. they're like, what are you talking about? These scripts are great. I'm like, yeah, thank you. But we're sleepy is what I meant to say. So it's just like, the show is excellent. I think we did a great job with it, turning it around. And the cast definitely felt really relieved because a lot of them were worried after having read early drafts of the scripts that they were going to, you know, say things that they didn't want to say or have to really consider whether or not they would actually want to be in the show, those kinds of things. And so I had to have a lot of conversations with some of the cast members, some of whom I actually knew in the past before, and just to let them know that authenticity was important to us. That was job number one, making sure that the characters felt real and not stereotypical and not a bad representation of how, you know, we want to showcase any kind of character. So we kind of went back in and kind of redid the show with a bit more compassion, a bit more love, a bit more authenticity, and then I'd say a bit more, I mean a lot more. And then we got the show to a place where I think everyone was really excited about and really happy with. So, and it's it's a great concept for a show. I think the idea of having two shows that are kind of different, but one is looking at the family's point of view, the Parker Andersons, looking at for family point of view, and then the second show is looking at the youngest daughter who she's dealing with selective mutism. She doesn't speak to anybody. And so seeing the world through her eyes in the second show is a really interesting thing to try. It's a really interesting nut to try to crack.
If you have a character that's looking at the world through selective mutism, how do you choose to, how do you display that? Like, how do you talk with your writers about how that needs to be portrayed and prepare that so it deals with the disability in a respectful way?
Yeah, well, I mean, that was the idea, right? We're just really want to be respectful, understand it. So we all kind of were sharing documentaries that we were watching and reading up on it, and just kind of, that was one of the first things we did, like really quickly early in the process, was just kind of understanding what this actually meant, how it comes about, like what is the right way to go about telling these stories. And we decided that Amelia Parker was going to, this is some stuff that was in the previous draft, but they never really figured it out. And so we kind of connected some dots that made it easier, was her mom had passed away, but we connected the trauma of that to her selective mutism, which is a real thing. That's sometimes what really happens. And so we wanted, and also there were these things where she was speaking to camera, but they never explained why in the old versions. So we changed it so that she's speaking it to camera, but she's talking to her mom who passed away a few years ago. And so she's making these messages for her mom as a way to kind of like connect to her mom. And so she talks to her camera, to herself, but she never speaks to anyone else. So that's how we used the talking to the camera thing to help us get into Amelia Parker's head and find out what she was dealing with and what she was doing, and just having a way for using that great actress, Millie Davis, to, you know, use her great voice to bring more depth to the character. So we did a lot of quick work, and then obviously if we had more time, I think it would have been even richer and even deeper, but we got to a really great place with it. I think for me, like I've been kind of working towards it slowly for years. Like, even like I've always taken on leadership roles, like from very early, like even like high school, like just were being, you know, student council president and being a supervisor at amusement parks and those kinds of things. And so the leadership part of it, I felt like I'd always been connected to it, always been working towards. And in terms of like learning the job, I'd always been, especially, you know, since theater school, I've always been like, I've been acting, I've been producing, I've been doing lights, I've been doing building sets. So I've learned a lot of different things as I went. I think for me, weirdly enough, the hardest thing has been like having people see me as a boss. you know, because a lot of times there's not a lot of, you know, back when I started, there weren't a lot of Black showrunners. There weren't a lot of, and I was in my mid, late 30s. And so there weren't a lot of Black showrunners who were like that young who were showrunners. And especially with The Secret Life of Boys being in the UK, there weren't a lot of showrunners in general in the UK. So, there's a few little hurdles where you kind of have to kind of explain to people, no, that my job is as the, I think of myself as the creative CEO. And it's kind of, back in the day, I didn't understand how to put that in words. And it's only been like through 6 or 7 years and show running, like, I don't know, like over 100 episodes of TV or whatever it is now, like knowing how to explain those things to other writers who are moving into that position, to just kind of give them a sense of like what their new role is going to be like. So for me, that's kind of like, was kind of like the hardest part, just kind of like getting people to see, to see, you know, me as a showrunner. And then also then from there, trusting in myself as a creative source of, you know, material for everyone who's working on the show. Like, I just had to get to a place where I was, because I'm Canadian, right? So I'm very nice and very sweet. So a lot of times I'm just kind of like, I don't want to ask for things. I feel like I'm putting a burden on people. And early in the process, I wouldn't ask for things because I was like, oh, well, who am I to ask for that? They know what they're doing. And then I get to the cut or I get to the edit room and I'm like, oh, I should have asked for it. And so now I'm in a place where I'm like, if I see something I want, if it's going to take a few extra minutes, I make sure I get it, because as it's, that stuff's going to come back on me. It's not going to come back on anyone else when it's time to bring it out to the world. Right. So, you know, there's a lot of little things you kind of struggle with as you go. Like in like any new job, you make mistakes, you learn from them, and then you get better every day. So those are kind of some of the few things I'm sure I struggle with over the years. But this is, you know, like I say to people, no one show is going to be perfect. No one showrunner is going to be perfect. There are going to be mistakes along the way. It's just going to be how you deal with those mistakes and how you move forward from them is what's going to set you apart.
And to that end, you actually founded the Showrunners Bootcamp up in Canada for BIPOC writers. Can I ask how did that come about, and what kind of curriculum do you focus on as part of that?
Yeah, so something I've been thinking about for a long time. So when I moved back to Canada in 2017, there weren't a lot of upper level BIPOC writers in the comedy side of things. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to change that as soon as I could, as, you know, with however I could, just by hiring writers and building them up and lifting them up to places. And after the George Floyd stuff started happening, there was more opportunities for BIPOC writers to run their own shows. But what's happening here in Canada, there's not a lot of training for, you know, showrunning. It's not something that you can just kind of go, well, how do I learn how to showrun? I just go to a school and figure it out. Like, there's just, you have to kind of learn from another showrunner, because other showrunners are the only ones who really know what this job entails. Mm-hmm. And I was lucky enough to learn from great showrunners, like not just Greg and Paul and Jen in The Office, but like showrunners on the Thundermans and on Little Mouse on the Prairie, and, you know, just people I've worked with over the years. But in Canada, a lot of times writers are not around on set. They're not around in post-production. So they don't get to see that side of things. And that's a big part of it when you're a showrunner. So while I was in the room on Overlord, I reached out to the WGC and said, if there are any BIPOC writers, mid-level, lower level, who want to kind of come in and audit our writer's room, I'm going to open it up one of the days so they can see it. And then I started realizing some of them were asking questions about my job as a showrunner. And I was like, oh, you know what? This is something that people here in Canada aren't getting experience on. So then I kind of had like a little 2-hour session where I just kind of talked about the basics of it. And I could tell, and this is September, this is late August, 2020. So we're, you know, deep in the pandemic and virtual rooms and all that sort of stuff. But I could tell then there was a hunger. People were like, just after the 2 hours, they're like, I need to know more. We got to do this again. Like, this has got to happen again. So at that point I said, you know, as soon as I have time, we're going to figure out a way to do a much more extensive boot camp. Cause I know there's a showrunners thing for the WGA that some of my friends have gone through. And I know that one of those things I wanted to go through, but I never had a chance to, because I moved away from the States before I had a credit that I could use to get in. But so when, like, after I was done shooting Overlord, I decided, you know, this is a good time to, and this is 2021, summer 2021, one of my friends, Jinder, Leigh G. Chalmers, she's like, hey, we gotta do this. I know you're working on a shortness boot camp. I've been talking to some people. We need to do this like ASAP because there's a lot of people who are getting opportunities and they do not know what the job is about. So because I knew that there were people getting opportunities, they weren't getting the proper training. What was going to happen, what happens a lot when BIPOC writers get chances, if they don't do it well, they don't get another chance. That's just unfairly, that's just what happens. So I wanted to set up as many writers I could with as much information as I could so that when they get their chance, they know what they're doing. They had their, you know, I've demystified a bunch of the job. I've explained how things work so that they are going into these jobs with just more information, more knowledge, and hopefully that would lead them to a better chance at success when they were done with it. And that's so far so good. Like a lot of people who are actually showrunning things while they're in the boot camp or about to showrun things after they were done the boot camp have been sending messages and just kind of saying, you know, this has been amazing. It's been so helpful. And we basically break down showrunning from the beginning to the end of it. So right from you've gotten greenlit, you have to choose a room. How do you choose a room? What are you looking for? The dynamics of you as a showrunner now that you're not just a writer, but you're a manager of people. How do you do that? We talked about your relationships with the broadcaster, with the production company, hiring the creative departments, like, you know, directors, production designers. What are you looking for? What should you be looking for? Those kinds of things. Sorry, my dog is upstairs.
It's okay.
Barking at someone who's dropping off a package.
I thought he was barking at the internet.
Moose is he's a very good barker. So we get into like talking with one of my line producers, Jim Corston, who was a really good friend of mine who worked at Overlord and Amelia Parker and Parker Anderson's. He came in, talked about his job, talked about budgets, talked about how he breaks things down, like how he works with showrunners. Talked to a post-production supervisor, Dave Huband, who has worked in Overlord. He came in, he's worked for years on different shows, including like Orphan Black and Tall Boys and Killjoys and a bunch of other things. Kind of broke down from the beginning of the process of post-production, say from just getting dailies to the very last delivery, like what, how that all works. So many writers were like, oh my goodness, I did not even think about all this stuff. Then I talked about how you work with the post-production supervisor. And then of course, working on set and just being there for your director, how, like what notes you should be giving, what notes you shouldn't be giving. Those are the kinds of things we kind of talked about. And then I brought in a few other showrunners who are Canadian BIPOC showrunners. Floyd Kane, who does Digstown. I brought in Marsha Green, who works on the Porter and then some other shows. And then also Vera Santamaria, who's the showrunner for the last season of Pen 15. And they kind of broke down their experiences as well, because I wanted the writers, these 53 writers who are part of this bootcamp, to not only get it from me, but to get it from people who are in the job right now and to get a sense of not just how I deal with things, but how other showrunners deal with things. And there's no one right way to do it, but there are a lot of things that are going to come at you and you have to tackle them in the way that you, that works the best for you. So it's just a matter of figuring that out faster.
It sounds like also a lot of, in running the Writers Bootcamp, a lot of your experience in like putting up plays in theaters back in LA has also fed into this. Would that be accurate?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Because all that is like, it's producing, it's getting a bunch of merry misfits together to figure out how you're going to entertain the world. And that's been my life, since high school and university. It's just kind of like, that's why I love Kermit the Frog so much, because I feel like he's my inspiration and my aspiration, just to become a person who is just surrounded by as many Muppets as possible, just trying to put on a good show.
So let me ask, Hollywood has been known for having a diversity problem over the decades that it's been in existence. If you could, you know, wave a magic wand, besides doing more writers boot camps in LA or showrunners boot camps in LA, what would you do to improve diversity in Hollywood?
I think the place where, at least I'll speak for Canada right now, I think the place where we need a lot more diversity right now is in the broadcasting ranks, like the people who are choosing which shows go on and how they go on and those kinds of things. I think that's, I think we're doing a good job of getting diversity into the writers' rooms a bit more now, but I think we're just thinking about those, the creative side of things. We need people on the business side as well, because you know, until you actually have decision makers and you know, those people in those seats who are people of, you know, people of color who understand those plights, I think not as much as we want to change can change. And I think in LA, in terms of like Hollywood and, you know, the American industry, I think same thing. I think we just need, you know, we're getting more and more people who are becoming decision makers, you know, and it's a lot of times it's like a writer or an actor who gets a deal and now they're kind of like starting their own company and doing things there, but then who's that money coming from? Like, it's generally speaking, like one of the billionaires who owns the broadcaster or the channels, right? So we need more people. We need more billionaires who are people of color who will be running networks. I think is that that's where we need to get to that part now too, so where you can start controlling more content. I think that that'll help things. And and the more, I think just the more people look to understand each other and look to actually like be empathetic and connect to people in a real way, I think things will continue to change for the better.
So I was wondering, who is your favorite philosopher, or what is your favorite philosophy quote?
Can I go back to Kermit the Frog?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I always think about the end of the movie. You know, life is a movie, write your own ending, keep believing, keep pretending. We've done just what we set out to do. Thanks to the lovers, the dreamers, and you. Like, I think if that doesn't get you going, I don't know how to help you.
And that is season 2, episode 4 of the Producers Lounge podcast. Thank you to my guest, Anthony Q. Farrell, for joining us. You can find out more about him by checking out the show notes and visiting our website at greaterandgrander.com. Our intro and outro music today was Mount Fuji by Bruce Arrizabalaga Quintet. Our episode still image is by Ricardo Tomas on Greater and Grander. If you have any questions or suggestions, we'd love to hear from you. Let us know in the episode comments. You can stay up to date by following us on social media at the handle Greater Grander, all one word. Join us next week for more cocktails and questions, and until then, keep producing dreams. Oh,